everybody across the land. Here's a special from Sequel Cast, though I don't know what it's gonna be about. Maybe Woody Allen, maybe Spike Lee, maybe Technicolor, maybe 3D, or maybe you just gotta wait and see. 'Cause you're gonna find out after this theme. This Sequel Cast special is a go. This Sequel Cast special is a go. What's it gonna be about? What's it gonna be about? What's it gonna be about? Who knows?
Okay, well, we're here in the Sequel Cast special. If this is the first time watching or listening, whatever, you know, we're still going to have the Sequel Cast special is a podcast that looks at topics, usually
movies.
Sort of freeform discussion about movie topics at large. And you can also check out our sister shows, Sequel Cast, in which you look at movies in a franchise one film at a time, and Sequel Commentary over at sequelcast.com. So this time around, a Sequel Cast special, we're doing a Sequel Cast special first. We're taking a broad look at a director, one of my favorites, Mel Brooks.
Oh, yeah.
Born Melvin James Kaminsky. He's 86 years young, as they say. And I don't know, like Mel Brooks, I watched a lot of his films as a kid. Did your family like grow up?
I watch a lot of his films now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that too. In fact, Go on.
I find that... Every year that goes by, and every time I revisit his films, I discover something new about them.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly... There's a lot of layers to Mel Brooks' humor, and while... I think this is a phrase from, like, Shakespearean times, but there's something called high humor and low humor. Low humor being sort of like farts and burps and blood, and high humor being typically like satire. And Mel Brooks kind of works in both those levels, like the best episodes of The Simpsons, for example. And Mel Brooks has been on The Simpsons, hasn't he?
Yes. There's an episode where Homer gets a job as a limo driver, and one of his passengers is Mel Brooks, and Homer insists on doing thousand-year-old man jokes with Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks reveals that he hates Carl Reiner.
You know,
How about this? How about this? I'll be Homer Simpson, and you be Carl Reiner. I hate Carl Reiner.
I had an experience once where I dated someone, and I was we're talking about movies, and I said, I really like Mel Brooks movies. And there was a pause, and she said, well, I don't like British movies that much. And I said, what? he's Yiddish, not British. He's Jewish, a Jewish comedian, filmmaker, actor.
He would appreciate
director.
That joke, actually.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a... kind of vaudevillian enough. And what do they say? Think Yiddish, dresh British? No, that's not quite it. Have you heard that? You haven't heard that phrase? No, I do tend to do that. If you want to check out any other Sequel Cast episodes, go to sequelcast.com. This is, of course, the Sequel Cast special, if you're just tuning in, on Mel Brooks. And I'm trying to, my family grew up watching a lot of Mel Brooks. The first Mel Brooks I might have seen is my dad might have rented a copy of, I think it would almost have to be Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein. I can't remember which one. But I saw them both around the same time when I was like in first grade. And I think even though Mel Brooks, the humor can be bawdy, I don't think it's really like that dirty necessarily. You know, you could show it to a kid.
It's vaudeville.
Yeah. And what do you mean by vaudeville? Explain that to our audience.
Well, vaudeville, like it's not dirty. It's not jokes that are dirty. It's jokes about being dirty.
Okay, that's a very subtle
distinction. Because like for instance, in Blazing Saddles, when we see Mel Brooks as the mayor, or the governor or whoever, and he has that buxom secretary. At no point does he goes, oh tits. He in just a hilarious turn goes, hiya boys, did you miss me? That is the difference. You know, that's the difference between burlesque and vaudeville. Burlesque, it's all in your face. Vaudeville, it's like, hey, let's wink, let's be sly, let's have some fun. But we know what we're talking about.
And, you know, did you know that Mel Brooks' son, Max Brooks, wrote a really interesting book that came out a few years ago called World War Z, which they're coming out with a movie in 2013 starring Brad Pitt. That appearing from that trailer, it seems very little to have to do with that book. But the book I thought was excellent. His son, Max Brooks, also was a writer on Saturday Night Live for a season or two recently.
Huh.
And I got the idea to do this sequel cast special on Mel Brooks because Amazon.com does a deal of the day thing. And they had one where the Mel Brooks Blu-ray box set that has like eight or nine films on it was only $25. And I could not pass that up. It's just a really good deal. So do you want to go through Mel Brooks' filmography kind of in order? And we can have
sure,
a discussion that way. Does that sound good? Or is there any Mel Brooks memories with your family? Like, did you watch it, like, with your friends in middle school and sleepovers or whatever? Or
No. Well, my family, like, myself, my brother, and my sister, we, like, the first Mel Brooks movie I ever remember seeing was Spaceballs, and we just loved that movie. We could not get enough of it, and we really bonded over it. So that's the most of my Mel Brooks movie memories are grown out of that. The only one that really involves the whole family is we had flown out to California to visit my aunt Nina and Uncle Frank, and we were there for 2 weeks, and it was a really good trip. We got to see Yosemite and some other Yosemite and the Golden Gate Bridge and a lot of really beautiful parts of the country, but one night, we're at home at Nina's place. We have nothing to do, and their local public television station shows Young Frankenstein, which at the time, I had no idea that it was a Mel Brooks movie. All I knew is it had the guy from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory in it.
Yeah.
So we stayed up late. We all stayed up late on a Saturday night watching it and just could not stop cracking up.
I remember as a kid, I was obsessed with Spaceballs, even though I never owned it on videotape for some reason, which was strange. I think my family never really collected videotapes, and that's something I...
They didn't believe in analog media storage, did they?
I think part of it is when I was younger, I lived overseas, and because of, like, formats and stuff, you could rent videotapes from local stores, but the selection was very, very limited. And they also had, like, a movie theater that was really limited that would get movies they'd screen sometimes. But Spaceballs, I remember liking and loving Spaceballs before I had ever seen Star Wars. And I still like the film.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I saw Spaceballs when I was like in second or third grade and loved it, but I really didn't see Star Wars for the first time, at least as far as I can recall, until I was like 12 or 13.
What? Wow.
Isn't
that
weird?
What is that like to see a parody film without seeing any of the things it's supposed to parody?
As a little kid, the only thing I knew about Star Wars was we had a Jabba the Hutt puzzle game. Or not puzzle, what do you call it? No, it's, yeah, fucking whatever. A Jabba the Hutt puzzle. And in addition to that, we had an Ewok board game, and that's all I knew about Star Wars was those two pieces of merchandise. I never had the toys. And I might have read, like, a Mad Magazine on one of the movies or something. But, like, that's all I knew. But I just thought Spaceballs was a real fun adventure story. And I liked the... It introduced me to puns. And watching it with my dad would laugh. And you know, when you're a little kid, you just imitate. So that's part of what influences your humor. I mean, my dad, speaking of humor, my dad showed me Woody Allen's film... Sleeper. He showed me Sleeper when I was like 6 or 7. And I always found the scene very moving where he makes an argument, God spelled backwards is dog. And as a 7-year-old, I found that very profound. But that's neither here nor there with Mel Brooks, although he does cover religion in his films as well, as Woody Allen does in his comedies. So let's go through chronologically, as we were suggesting earlier, about Mel Brooks' career of films he was a writer and director of.
Okay.
What voice was that, Thajer?
That was a guy who, you know, he likes Mel Brooks. And he's like, oh, he's positive about it. He wants to move forward with the show. Okay. Yeah, let's talk about the movie. Let's talk about the next one.
Okay. The next movie we're talking about is the producers. I did two or three accents very bad just then. The producers is Mel.
Tell me, sir, did they have movies back in your day?
They did have movies back in the day. What happened is Uncle Randolph would get a copy of Little Orphan Annie and shake it really fast back and forth, and we thought it was moving. So and he said, "See, look at that. It's moving. It's a movie." That's what we thought movies were. So it's pretty simple. No, so Mel Brooks. Oh, Jesus, you're gonna put that every
they
time
like us,
they can.
Man. They like that little.
They like it. Yeah.
I don't know what that was a tribute to, but they liked it.
Is a bad New York accent in Saturday Night Live tradition. The Producers is Mel Brooks' first film as a writer-director, which won an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay. And The Producers is later redone as a Broadway musical and later as a movie, I guess basically remade as the stage musical version.
Well, the movie was adapted to the stage to a stage musical.
Yes.
The stage musical was adapted to a movie musical.
Yep.
And I believe it's going to be a first-person shooter next.
Call of Duty Springtime for Hitler Edition. Sounds great.
Yeah.
But no, The Producers, it wasn't the first Mel Brooks film I saw, but I really liked it. You know, the original film stars Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder, Willy Wonka himself. And it's a satire of, among other things, Broadway economics. And even the original movie has some songs in it, you know, most famously Springtime for Hitler. How would you sum up the plot?
Well, I mean, it's a fallen Broadway great was desperate to revitalize his career, and since he and a the bank, you know, his finances are all shot, so the bank sends an accountant to help fix it up, and because of the accountant's offhand comment about the way the money is handled on Broadway, Max Bialystock, the producer, decides, well, rather than try to resurrect my career, I'll just come up with a scheme to embezzle a whole bunch of money and retire.
Yeah.
And they become accomplices in that endeavor.
In fact, The Producers, the film, originated the phrase creative accounting, which is...
Really?
Yeah, I believe so, and which is really, really a famous phrase. And, you know, I've done some accounting with my day job, and
yes.
I'm being vague about this on purpose, but accounting is... a science, but sometimes you just gotta shuffle things around a bit to make one month seem profitable and the next month not. So, and that's part of where you get with the producer. Zero Mostel is such a force of nature as a Max Bialystock in the film. He's like scary. Just the scene where he's screaming at Gene Wilder about the blanket, and Gene Wilder's like, "That's my blanket! That's my blanket!" It's so intense. You feel horrible, and you feel like you're like peeking on a real moment that you shouldn't be spying on.
Well, you know what it is? Is that Zero Mostel is Max Bialystock? He's a human penis.
Why do you say that?
No, I'm serious. Yeah. Like, you know, he's up. He's energetic. He's looking to have some intense fun, and then he's kind of down.
When he gets excited, he
and
turns
then all
red.
All of a sudden, he comes back up again, and it gets really intense, and you're overwhelmed, and then it goes away.
Yeah, it's just real something. And wasn't Zero Mostel the original Tevier in Fiddler on the Roof?
I believe he was, yeah.
Yeah, that would have been a show to see live. Not that either of us were live back then, but there's certainly that soundtrack album of Zero Mostel.
Speak for yourself, also time travel.
Yeah, time travel. If I invented time travel, the first thing I'd do would see classic Broadway shows.
No, actually, I'm not kidding. That's what I would do. I would go to the Cavern Club and see the Beatles.
Oh, man, yeah.
I'd like... I would experience art from different.
You would see
periods.
The police at you see the police at Heebie-Jeebies. Wait, is that L.A.?
CBGBs.
I'm a moron. I don't know music.
I see lots of people at CBGBs.
Yeah. I mean, Mel Brooks is. Oh, I guess it's with The Producers. Is there something that really sticks out for you? I guess we should start with. Have you seen the musical of it, either on stage or the movie version?
Yes.
Oh, which one?
The filmed version of the stage musical.
And what did you think?
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, I guess, like in my heart and mind, the original Producers will be the Producers. I think I would have much rather have seen the musical version on the stage. But then again, for all intents and purposes, that might as well have been the stage version that they filmed for the film version.
Right. It's.
I mean, it's not bad in any way. Mm-hmm. That's just the way my mind links all the things up.
Yeah, the director of the movie, I can't think of her name, but she was the director of the stage version as well. And sometimes when that happens, it looks a bit stagey. And you have very pretty sets, but, you know, visually it's not that dynamic. Although, to be fair, Mel Brooks's directorial style can be accused as being sort of static as well. And at least early on in his career, you know, he did very good filming song and dance sequences later in his films. I got to see the producers in New York. Have I told you this, Thrasher?
No.
Okay,
no,
and of course, this is the first time for the audience. Hello out there in YouTube land. We're all amateurs. I saw it. It was after the original run with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. And instead, in the Matthew Broderick part, it was Steven Weber from Wings and from Dracula Dead and Loving It. It should be mentioned, a Mel Brooks film. And in the part of Max Bialystock, it was Nathan Lane's understudy, Peter Bart, who has a role in the remake musical film of the producers. And he looks and kind of sounds like a more fit Nathan Lane.
Huh.
And Steven Weber was good, but I think his performance was maybe a bit too nebbish. Like, I don't, like, Matthew Broderick can do the nervous thing and you kind of believe him, but Steven Weber has some sort of, I don't know, like, untraditional good look. So there's something about him where, with that part, it didn't quite fit, and that he could have had a better singing voice. But I think he was still good in the role. And I think a lot of the songs in the musical are great, and there's songs that they filmed for the film that cut out of the film. A really good one early on is The King of Broadway, where Nathan Lane says, "I used to be the king of old Broadway." And he sings about all these failed shows he did and how he used to be an impresario, and he's now sort of like a bum.
Yeah, I love the King of Old Broadway number. Yep. Well, that's, you know, one thing that Mel Brooks has certain signatures that kind of pop in and out of his movies. You know, one of them being the line, "It's good to be the king,"
yeah,
which is worked in there.
Sure.
"I used to be the king."
It's good to be
it's
the king.
It's good to be the king.
No, that's very true. The next Mel Brooks film is one of his most obscure, The 12 Chairs. Have you seen this one?
Sadly, no. It's like, my parents actually got a Mel Brooks DVD collection, and every time I go to visit them,
yeah,
for a weekend or for a holiday, you know, I want to go, you know, I want to watch something in that collection, and I always go to the collection looking to watch that one, because I've been meaning to see it for quite some time, and I always end up putting in something else.
I've seen it once. I plan to see it again with the Blu-ray set I just purchased on sale, and it's an adaptation of a sort of a Russian novel.
It's a Tolstoy, isn't it?
It's by, the novel is by Ilf and Petrov.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But I mean, it very much comes off as like a Chekhov short story or something Tolstoy. I mean, at the heart of it is probably some criticism of the Russian government at the time when it was written in 1928 that I'm missing. And I mean, this has been made into a film a few times before, but this film, in the lead, stars Frank Langella, who was Dracula in a movie in the 70s, I think. And Dom DeLuise, Mel Brooks' mainstay, is in it. And another part in the lead is Ron Moody, who played Fagin in the movie musical of Oliver.
Really? The I'm reviewing
the situation.
That one?
Baddies, wow. At a baddie all his life, all the trials, the tribulation, I can't sing. Okay, yeah. I always gotta self-deprecate myself here on the Sequel Cast. If you like the Sequel Cast special on Mel Brooks and want to hear more, go to sequelcast.com. Okay. With the 12... Jesus.
That's been our ad.
If we had a custom soundboard, you'd be pushing the button every 5 seconds. With, like, fart sound
effects.
Well,
I would preload all of my comments and just assemble them as I go.
The Thrasher bot, very good. So, yeah, 12 Chairs, Mel Brooks' second film. It's it kind of grows on you. Some of it's more dramatic. It was filmed in, I don't know if it was filmed in Czechoslovakia or Russia or what, but the scenery, it was filmed in Europe, certainly. I'm very ignorant of geography. I apologize, international listeners, of which we have many to the Sequel Cast. In fact, Sequel Cast, aside from the United States, which we're from, is most popular in Australia and the UK. So, Howdy Doody International.
So good
listeners.
On you and pip pip.
Thumbs up. Ah, okay. I'm so stupid. It's so weird watching myself talk on Google Hangout.
well, then don't. Just tune that out.
I'll put a piece of paper over it so I can't see myself. So, I mean, it's sort of like has the tone of a fable. Mel Brooks has a very small part in the film as well. It has a great musical number written by Mel Brooks that is one of his better ones. I cannot come up with the name for this fucking thing. But it's called something like Hope for the Best, Expect the Worst. But it sounds like a traditional like Russian folk song. It's very clever in its arrangement. This movie, the producers, Mel Brooks' first film, was a huge success, played in New York for several weeks, even months on end. But The 12 Chairs was a big flop, sadly. And I think it's enjoyable. You get to care about some of the characters. And I'd recommend you watch it, Thrasher, next time at your parents' house. Or next time we visit, I'll drag along my copy of this film and we can watch it in a hotel room at some convention or something.
All right.
Whatever happens. The next film is one of Mel Brooks's more famous. In 1974, you know, two of his most famous films came out. Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein. We'll start with Blazing Saddles, starring, of course, Cleveland Little. And Richard Pryor was a co-writer of the script.
He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star, he came to offer battle to bad men near and far. Oh, that's a great movie.
Blazing Saddles. Did you watch Westerns as a kid? Did you get sort of all the stuff they were making fun of? Or as you grew older, is it something you appreciate more?
It's something I appreciate more now because, after attending, I took a lot of film classes in college, and so I learned, and after college exposed myself much more to classic Westerns.
Yeah.
One of the things that's amazing about Mel Brooks and his parodies is that he really learns the language of the genre that he's doing a parody of. So
sure.
Now that I'm much more literate in the language of the Western, Blazing Saddles has taken on a whole new level for me. It is a truly... it's an amazing movie. It's a parody of Westerns made as if it was a legitimate Western.
And even filmed in that style, even like the set dressing and stuff. I was doing some research for this Sequel Cast special episode of Sequel Cast on Mel Brooks. And I was reading, even when they were picking out props, they picked out, you know, like period appropriate props, like real tin for the mugs, the steins at the bar and stuff. And it's that attention to detail that really shows up in this and in his next film, Young Frankenstein, that he doesn't just make fun of the genre, but he also reveres it in a way. It's not just a bunch of characters dressed up in cowboy hats farting, although there's that too.
Well, he works with the genre on its own terms and plays by the genre's own rules. That's one of the things that makes his movie so good. And so much unlike the parodies of today.
Yeah, I mean, any Mel Brooks movie, even his lesser films, can kick the shit out of any, like, date movie or epic movie or, you know, any modern attempt at parody films. Don't push enough as much as Mel Brooks did. He works on several levels, as we talked about at the start of the show.
Well, you know, part of it is that in Mel Brooks movies, so much of it is played straight. Like, until the gag comes along, you might actually think you were watching an actual Western or an actual horror movie or an actual space opera. And this is actually something really cool. In 2005, the composer who did the musician who did the theme for Blazing Saddles was interviewed by Terry Gross on Fresh Air, and he revealed something that just kind of blew me away. When Mel Brooks hired him to do the theme song, to write and perform the theme song for Blazing Saddles, he was never told that it was a comedy.
Hmm.
He was just told the title is Blazing Saddles. Yeah. You have to work that title into the song, and it's about a town, a desperate town that gets a new sheriff who does good, and that's all he knew.
Wow.
And so he wrote a straight song, and because And that's what I think. One of the reasons that song works so well is the theme. It could be the theme for a serious Western. And the fact that it's attached to this movie makes it comedic.
Yes, and it sets the tone off of the film right. And at the end of the film, it gets really breaks out of the fourth wall with a very funny cameo.
That's another Mel Brooks signature.
Yes, with a very funny cameo by Dom DeLuise as a director of a ridiculous musical movie.
Called The French Mistake.
Yes. And
just
yeah,
great. And you get, you know, like, come on, boys, this is a Mel Brooks movie.
But you even get the level of breaking the fourth wall of characters from Blazing Saddles going to the concession stand to buy candy before going to the movie theater to watch the movie that you just were watching. It's insane, and. And, you know, Blazing Saddles is a film that was actually admitted to the, I don't know the title of it officially, the U.S. Film Registry, the National Film.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, it is the film Registry.
Yeah, you know, and that's something where they can have things in there that are irreverent, that span genres, and if you're going to pick a Mel Brooks film, Blazing Saddles is going to go on. I mean, the next one, Young Frankenstein. If you think the cinematography in Blazing Saddles is great, my God. Young Frankenstein, the black and white look, the sets. I think they even had access to some of the original props from Frankenstein.
Yes.
And Bride of Frankenstein.
Actually, that's true. They used a lot of the surviving sets from Bride of Frankenstein because they were just standing sets. But they had most of the props, and the whole reason that happened is that the studio didn't own those props. They were actually rented from this like prop warehouse that specialized in bulky electronic goods.
Wow!
And that prop warehouse still existed. And this is, you know, Mel Brooks' attention to detail. When he found out it still existed, he tracked it down and he got as many of those pieces of equipment as he could get to put on the set. And that's one of the things that makes this movie so authentic and so great. And the other thing that's brilliant about it is it's all black and white, which even at the time was a ballsy choice.
Yep. 1974, sure.
Oh, yeah.
But it adds so much to the film. If they would have done it in color, half the jokes would have been lost. The thing Mel Brooks really does well, as you pointed out earlier, Thrasher, is he respects the kind of film he's making fun of, even to the point of the visuals, even down to the tiniest detail, the tiniest speck of dust on the table. It's really fascinating. And, of course, Marty Feldman started his long collaboration with Mel Brooks in this film as Igor, or is it Igor?
Igor.
Igor, okay.
Now, Igor was my father. My grandfather. He worked with your grandfather.
It's... I'll have to check this out in the Blu-ray set. I'm trying to figure out which one I should pop in first. And it might just be Young Frankenstein. It's...
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, Young Frankenstein is my favorite. And that's a choice that it breaks my heart to make, but I cannot get enough Young Frankenstein.
And the makeup for the monster, played by Peter Boyle, is great, too. I mean, just like the original Frankenstein movie and even the original novel by Mary Shelley. Have you read the novel?
Actually, no. I recently bought a copy.
Okay,
it's something I am looking to dig into soon.
I think it's an easier, it's a more compelling read than Bram Stoker's Dracula, I would argue. But anyway, like, you know, Frankenstein and other movies and books and things, the monster in Young Frankenstein, you feel sympathy for, which is a big point of the story, whether it's done as a straight version or a parody. Is this thing was born into existence and everyone hates him, and like, why? You know, it's
such is the human condition.
Sure, humans love to criticize. If you want to hear other sequels or other things we've criticized, go to sequelcast.com to check out other sequelcast specials or the sister show Sequelcast and Sequel Commentary.
So, actually, something else about Young Frankenstein that I love is that the comedy is relentless. Like, once it gets going, everything is a joke and everything pays off and everything is there to elicit a response. And this is, I can't get enough of Kenneth Mars in this movie.
Oh, wow. And Kenneth...
He will rule the day he was born. What? He will rule the day he was ever born of Frankenstein. It's just so great. That wooden arm, he's always flipping around.
Sure, and it should be mentioned, Gene Wilder, who was co-starred in Blazing Saddles and plays, you know, Dr. Frankenstein and Young Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
Thank you very much. Is he co-wrote this? And I watched a A&E biography on him about 10 years ago, and he was saying after Young Frankenstein, Gene Wilder wanted to work on Mel Brooks and do a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, directed by Mel Brooks, starring Gene Wilder, and
that would have been
and
amazing.
There was a whole script done for it, and Mel Brooks decided to go in a different direction and focus on his acting as well, and went off and did Silent Movie instead. But
I want to see that script.
Can you imagine?
I want to read that script.
Yeah, it's because Gene Wilder is a really good actor, and as he did in Young Frankenstein and The Producers and a number of other things he was in, he could go from like serious to totally intense and insane in a matter of minutes. And just to think what a Gene Wilder, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde would have been with Mel Brooks, would have been something else. Like maybe, like Gene Wilder is still alive. Maybe he'll release that script, or maybe there'll be a staged reading of it, or I don't know.
they'll do an animated feature.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, but I would love to see that in some form. Because on the documentary, they showed a few pages of that script, and I was like, I want to read that fucking thing. I bet that would have been great. So after his two big films in 1974, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks did another ballsy genre to take on, Silent Movie, in 1976.
It's an obscure one, but that's actually another one of my favorites. I love the physical comedy. I love the decision to go as a silent movie, although I do love that Marcel Marceau, the famous mime, has the only speaking part in this film.
Yes.
And it's just a great parody of, like, the old studio system.
It is. It's, you know, I haven't seen very many silent films. I took some film courses in college. I saw some Charlie Chaplin shorts, some Harold Lloyd shorts. Is that his name, Harold Lloyd, the other main guy?
Harold Lloyd,
right,
yes.
With the glasses.
Seen a Buster Keaton?
Probably a clip. You know, part of the problem...
See the General.
Absolutely, see the General. No, I've been meaning to see that for years. And with the film history courses I took in college, I think really to do a film history course proper, you need to have lab hours to make it so you watch a whole film outside of class with the teacher doing commentary on it. And just watching clips removed doesn't communicate what a whole film is. Did you ever take film history courses at SCAD or Alma Mater?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, I took those.
Did you ever get to watch...
I took a couple of film history courses, a couple of technical courses.
Yeah, as did I. And, I mean, what did you think of, like, film history as a course to teach? Or, I mean, to attend?
I mean, It's important, but at this point, there's kind of so much to cover.
Yeah.
I almost wish it had been broken up into two classes.
Great point.
One field that covered everything like before the 1970s and the film school generation, and then one that covered everything from there to the modern day.
Sure. I this is a little bit off topic, but when I took a film history course, they showed a clip. They said, now we're going to show a clip from Scarface, and a bunch of people in class are like, Scarface, that movie's tight. I love this movie. And they were showing, like, the 1930s Scarface. There was a silent film of which the more famous Scarface film starring Al Pacino, it's certainly not a remake. I don't know what the hell you call it. Like, very loosely inspired.
Well, it's just another movie drawn from the same source material.
Yeah. Can we call it reboot? I don't even know what you...
It's just another Scarface.
It's another, totally different Scarface.
It's a remake. When you make a film based on a film, it's just another movie if you make a film based on the same source material that another movie might have been based on.
I really hate the phrase reimagining.
I prefer deimagining, because that's what those usually are.
Oh, okay. Silent Movie, I love a scene from this film where Burt Reynolds is taking a shower, and all of a sudden all of these hands creep up behind him to soap him all around.
Oh, yeah. And, he's a hairy guy.
Yeah, a very hairy individual. He Burt Reynolds posted in posed in Playgirl at one point for an infamous pictorial. And we also talked about Burt Reynolds on episodes of the sequel cast on Smokey and the Bandit way back when.
Oh, those were we ever so young.
We were 3 years ago when we recorded those episodes.
Oh, and actually, Silent Movie may have the most sophisticated and most subtle boner joke ever committed to film.
What is it? I haven't seen the film in a while, so what's the boner joke you're talking about?
Oh, well, it's when the Engulf and Devour Film Corporation decides to use a woman to break up the Silent Movie partnership.
Yeah.
And so the guy at the board meeting, he unrolls this big picture of the sex bomb that they're going to drop on Mel Brooks and his crew, and all the board members kind of like put their hands in their chins and lean forward. And then if you notice, the boardroom table is slowly rising. And, like, you don't really notice it's rising until it's too late, and then you just cannot help but crack up.
You mentioned silent film as sort of an obscure movie. The next film directed and written by Mel Brooks is also a bit more obscure, I think. High Anxiety came out in 1977, the same year as Star Wars. Episode 4, A New Hope.
You know what?
Yes.
I know I said that Young Frankenstein is my favorite. However, I think High Anxiety is the best put together of all of Mel Brooks's films. It is a stylistic satire of Hitchcock filmed as if it were a Hitchcock movie.
Interesting. Yeah, I first saw High Anxiety when I got the Mel Brooks box set on DVD, and now of course I bought it again on Blu-ray. To upgrade my collection to high definition for what that's worth. And I think like a lot of Mel Brooks stuff, the more you're familiar with the source material, in the case of High Anxiety, Hitchcock films, the more you'll get out of it.
Yeah, I actually once watched this with somebody who really didn't know Hitchcock, and like there's this parody of The Birds where he's in a park and progressively larger birds keep defecating on him. And I was just cracking up, and the person I was watching it with said, well, what is this? Why is this in the movie? Why is this happening? And then I tried to explain the birds and all this other stuff. But it's like you will get so much more out of it once you've gotten a number of Hitchcock films under your belt.
Yeah, and Alfred Hitchcock was alive at the time High Anxiety came out, and he really loved the film, and Mel Brooks even showed him a rough cut. And in the same interview that I read that I was talking about earlier, Mel Brooks told a story. He showed a rough cut of High Anxiety, and there's the Psycho parody scene where the newspaper, the guy, you know, hits him with Mel.
Here's your paper. Here's your paper. Here.
He hits
so great.
Mel Brooks in the shower with a rolled up newspaper, and Mel Brooks is showing a rough cut to Alfred Hitchcock, and Alfred Hitchcock says, "You know, when we did this scene in Psycho." In this framing of the shot, we had 12 shower rings. You only have 8. And Mel Brooks is like, wow. Really, that
did
guy.
Did they go back and reshoot?
No. It was too late, but it was one of those things like, you know, like nowadays, if you're trying to, and when they did this shot, the relatively shot-for-shot remake of Psycho directed by Gus Van Sant in the 90s, they took the Psycho DVD and did, they printed out still screens of every single frame, prior to every single different shot, at least, so they could mirror it on set. But, you know, when Mel Brooks did High Anxiety in 77, they couldn't do it. They didn't have really the technology to do that, apart from, would you take a photograph of, like, a film? I don't know, but...
Well, no, you could make photographic prints from
film,
a film.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it wasn't nearly as easy to do as...
It certainly would take more time.
Yeah, you have to go to a photographic shop that could do that. And you'd have to get a workable copy of the print of the film to work from to begin with.
Yeah, that ideally looked good and everything. High Anxiety. Mel Brooks, I think, has one of his more dramatic performances in this film. He tries to play more of the straight man, not sort of the crazy side guy.
Yeah.
And he's good. And the song High Anxiety is a lot of fun. It almost sounds a bit like a Sinatra sort of tune.
It actually does. Like it does have that kind of feel. One thing that also stands out is the the people who run the mental institution, they're
Harvey Korman and what's the other actress?
They're all like they're engaged in this like sadomasochistic relationship.
Yeah,
this weird like whole psychosexual thing going on, and there's this just it has my, one of my favorite lines: less sadism, more masochism. Yes, it's so good.
Or the whole gag where Harvey Korman
really see that on
Harvey Korman's trying to act like a werewolf to make a guy be convinced he's scared all the time, and he puts in these fake teeth and just it's. There's a lot of real fun stuff. I have to revisit all these films through this box set.
Well, there's like a lot of like little sexual things because like the beginning when it's Mel Brooks traveling through the airports and he goes into the men's room and then he runs out of the men's room being chased by this guy. He's like, come on, it's the 70s, everybody's doing it. And like just like it's sex that you don't see or that you didn't see on film.
Or consequently, there's a scene at another point in the film where the Mel Brooks' character is on the phone and he's hearing someone being stabbed to death, but he thinks it's someone having sex. He thinks it's like an erotic moment, right?
Oh yeah.
And just very very funny stuff.
But then there's also the scene where he's at the psychiatrist conference, or the psychiatric conference, and he's giving his speech about the myth of penis envy. And then, like, a doctor comes in with his two kids, and he immediately has to, like, sort of clean up his language, even though he's only using medical terms.
Right.
That's
pretty good stuff. So,
but really, I mean, like, that kind of links into Psycho, which is really all about this sort of psychosexual torment that drives this man to kill, and it just comes out in High Anxiety as a bit more freewheeling.
Yes, as was fitting with the sexual politics of the time in the 70s. Now, I mean, so Mel Brooks did a real flurry of films we've talked about from the late 60s through the 70s, but he took a four-year break before coming out with History of the World Part 1.
Oh, yeah. Which is a stylistic parody of epics.
But several kinds of epics. You have the caveman epic. Yeah. You have like Spartacus, Roman gladiator sort of stuff.
The historical epic, the biblical epic. The
French.
Every kind of epic. And in the end, the sci-fi epic with Jews in space.
I had a friend who first introduced me to History of the World Part 1, and he was convinced that Mel Brooks made a History of the World Part 2 based on the parody trailer at the end.
Lots of people were, and as much as I would love to see those, I would love to see those movies, I'm kind of glad there isn't a Part 2.
But what I love is Mel Brooks sometimes carries gags throughout movies, and at the end of History of the World Part 1 with the fake trailer for Part 2, Jews in Space, the melodies were Jews, were Jews in Space. And he takes that same melody and later revives it in Robin Hood Men in Tights. We're men, we're men in tights.
We're always on guard defending the people's rights.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's just history. I think History of the World Part 1 is a more uneven film. My family had never seen it before, and I was like in middle school, so I rented it. We watched it as a family, and it opens with a gag about cavemen discovering masturbation. Talk about something awkward to watch with your family. I just felt really embarrassed. I think my dad and my mom walked out of the room, and I sat watching the movie by myself.
Well, the thing is, though, if you're at a certain age when you see that and you haven't really discovered masturbation yourself, you think it's just a bunch of monkeys acting crazy.
Right, because it's also a parody of the Kubrick 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it works on a couple of different levels. And, like, that's one thing that I do kind of like is that a lot of the sex gags in the Mel Brooks movies can go over the audience's head depending on what their level of sophistication is.
Yep. That's a great point. And, you got something for the kids and something for the adults.
And, that Jews, actually where the movie sort of slows down for me is in the French Revolution
at
segment,
the end.
Although I love the ancient Rome biblical segment. And I love, like, just the quick little things. I bring you these 15, these 10 commandments. Just those little quick scenes are great and keep the film's momentum going. But, like, that Jews in Space scene just really shows how committed Mel Brooks is, because not only does he write this scene, he then composes an original song for it, and then gets Star Wars level special effects for the scene
with models and motion cameras and
those
everything.
Effects are amazing.
Absolutely. And History of the World Part 1, I really like the very short Spanish Inquisition song and dance number, like a Bugsley Berkeley musical. The Inquisition, what a show, the Inquisition, here you go. Yeah, it's,
you know,
it's a lot
what
of fun.
It is? Like, here's the deal. A lot of really funny things can be murdered through over-repetition. Like, Monty Python, a lot of brilliant Monty Python routines have been murdered for people because they're constantly quoted, particularly among the gaming community.
Yeah.
And among, like, if you're into wargaming and role-playing, particularly if that intersects with Warhammer 40K, or any other gaming setting where there is an Inquisition, you cannot stop people from quoting
really?
That song.
Okay.
Yeah, well, the thing is, done at the right time, that can be funny, but there are some people you just want to punch. Like, please, please, musical numbers have no place in the world of Grimdark. Shut up. You don't. It's one of those things where, like, if it's repeated often enough, you start to doubt whether people actually get the point of that musical number.
Yeah, because it's a funny joke about a very tragic subject in history.
And it's every kind of musical number.
Yes,
it's show stopping musical number. Yep. It's patter song, but it's also like Busby Berkeley. Every kind of musical number you would have in a film is represented in the Inquisition number.
I love the terrible joke in History of the World Part 1 where the heroes in various sequences of the film get in a difficult situation. They said, "We need a miracle to get us out of this." And then they hear,
oh, and
the horse
miracle named
Miracle
shows up. Yeah.
And did you, is there a little, yeah, and here's a little bit of trivia. Did you know that the, Gregory Hines, you know, has a big part in the Roman segment.
Oh, star of Eve of Destruction, yes.
And Running Scared with Billy Crystal. Gregory, that part was originally meant to be played by Richard Pryor, but around that same time as when Richard Pryor got into the big accident with the cocaine pipe blowing up in his face, so he couldn't do the part.
Yeah.
And Gregory Hines is great, but Richard Pryor also would have been great.
Yeah, that is an interesting the connection between Mel Brooks and Richard Pryor is an interesting creative partnership, and I can totally buy that part was written for Pryor, but I think Hines does a really good job.
Yeah, and Gregory Hines died fairly young, sadly. He was in his 50s or 60s or something. I don't know if it was cancer, but he was a great actor, of course. So between History and the World Part 1 and his next film, there's a six-year gap, so a bigger gap between films. And this isn't uncommon when directors become older or become more active in other things, such as acting, being cameos on TV shows and stuff like that.
Well, I think he was doing more producing at the time.
Right, through his production company Brooks Film. He produced the David Cronenberg film that was a remake, The Fly, starring Jeff Goldblum. He
also did To Be or Not to Be as an actor and producer.
Yes, although he didn't direct it, all of that one is in the Mel Brooks Blu-ray collection, which is kind of strange. But he stars in it with his wife, Anne Bancroft. Have you seen To Be or Not to Be?
Yeah.
We can talk about that for a minute.
Yes, I have, and I think it's a great film. But you know, if you get it expecting a Mel Brooks film, you're going to be in for a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I've never seen the original To Be or Not to Be, and
I've
meant to see that for years.
And despite all that, it does have some just amazingly comedic segments,
yes.
Like when the guy, you know, gets up on stage and like says the first word in a Shakespearean soliloquy, and then one guy in the audience stands up and walks out.
Yeah, it's
that's fucking brilliant. And it also, you know, it's also just got this sort of grim, this, because it is set, you know, in the run up to the full on outbreak of World War II, there, you know, is, or no, World War II had broken out when the film takes place. There is kind of this grim wisdom throughout it. One line that you know really sticks with me is when, you know, Mel Brooks, somebody's talking about the various people that the Nazi Party is targeting, and Mel Brooks just says, "If it weren't for fags, Jews, and gypsies, there'd be no theater."
That is a great line.
It's an amazing line.
Yeah, I'd like to watch To Be or Not to Be again. But I mean, you're right. The tone is more restrained than Mel Brooks directed films. He only starred in, and I don't think there's that many movies that Mel Brooks starred in with a leading role that he did not direct.
Yeah. And he also did The Elephant Man.
Produced The Elephant Man, right? Directed by David Lynch.
But then he made a lot of people's favorite movie of all time,
Spaceballs. Yeah. writer, director, actor, producer on Spaceballs. Parody. And so 87, when this came out, this was 4 years after Star Wars Return of the Jedi, Episode 6. And Spaceballs, I haven't seen this all the way through in a really long time. The last time I saw it is when I taught at a computer camp in 2004, so almost a decade ago. And one of the movies we rented for the kids was Spaceballs. And watching this, even though I never owned a copy of this film, I found it was one of those films I inadvertently had memorized the entire thing.
Yep.
And, like, it was just a bit too much. I had to sort of distance myself. I was like, had to get out of the room just because I know this too well.
It may just be because of how often our generation was exposed to it when it came out, but Spaceballs may very well be the most quotable and quoted of all Mel Brooks movies.
And I think as far as, like, home video, DVD, and Blu-ray sales, it's one of Mel Brooks' bestsellers, period.
Well, and that's the other thing, is that in addition to being a satire of Star Wars and space opera and blockbusters, it's a satire of the home video revolution, which was hitting full swing at the time.
Definitely. And
that lengthy segment about instant video cassettes that are in stores before the movie has finished production.
And you look at now where you have movies as available as digital downloads a week in advance of it coming to theaters. For independent films, that's almost that thing coming true in a way.
And merchandising, where the real money from the movie is made.
Did you ever see Spaceballs, the animated series?
I saw two episodes.
Yeah. Not so good, despite participation from Mel Brooks and most of the cast of the film.
Yeah.
The animation looks like it was done with Adobe Flash. I could be mistaken, but...
It was Flash or really poorly used After Effects.
And the possibilities of Spaceballs with an animated show are really quite tremendous, but...
It has a tremendous potential, but the mistake they made was they made it too topical. Right, because that's the thing about Mel Brooks' movies is, in their own way, they are timeless because they are based, his parodies are based on types of film that are still with us and that are very deeply important to the history of film.
Yep.
But if you do your first episode about Jurassic Park and the baseball steroid scandal, well, once that scandal wraps, it loses most of its impact.
No, as dated, and the animation style doesn't help anything. But watching the film Spaceballs, I love the vocal Spaceballs theme over the end credits. It's a ridiculous 80s... it sounds like almost like a Poison or song or some like falsetto hard rock. And a little bit of hip-hop.
It's a rock and hip-hop thing. Well, you know what it is, though, and this didn't dawn on me until more recently, is that even that song is a parody. It's a parody of expository songs that show up in the credits of movies.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about favorite lines from films. I love the line in Spaceballs where I forget what the Death Star in the film is called.
Mega Maid.
It transforms into Mega Maid. The Spaceball turns into Mega Maid. And it's a vacuum, and then they flip a switch on the inside, and it goes, she's going from suck to blow.
Oh, it's
something. Not only is that a visual gag with what's happening with sucking the oxygen or returning the oxygen to the planet of Druidia, but it's also a blowjob joke.
It's a sex joke,
yeah. And
it's about the Schwanz.
May the Schwanz be with you. Schwartz be with you. Yeah, it's
May the Schwartz be with you.
It just makes me miss Rick Moranis, who is retired as an actor, but was in a lot of great films in the 80s and 90s, not to mention SCTV before then.
I have to get this out. What's the matter, Colonel Sanders? Chicken?
Even we have Mr. Coffee and Mr. Radar.
Yeah, the user-friendly technology gags are great. That's one thing about this about Spaceballs that blows my mind is that the further we get from 1987, the more accurate and real the movie is.
Also, it has John Candy in one of his best roles, and John Candy. Oh. I mean, I don't know what it is about overweight comedians that tend to have them die early, and I'm sure health-related issues are part of it. And sometimes it's with John Candy. I think it was a health related issue. I don't think it was drug related issues.
He had a chronic metabolic problem.
Yeah.
Or Which is what led to what eventually took him from us.
Sure.
As opposed to like Belushi and Farley, where it was drug abuse.
Right. And but he plays a Chewbacca character, and he's like called Barf. He's
the Mog,
yeah,
part man, part dog, his own best friend.
And it's just a lot of fun. I just really miss John Candy, and he's great in Spaceballs. And it's a bit. I wonder if he'd lived longer, if he would have had like a part in the Mel Brooks films, like Robin Hood, Men in Tights, or Dracula Den, loving it.
I'm sure he would. I mean, I think he would. He would have made a great like Friar Tuck character if Mel Brooks hadn't grabbed that for himself. But like another thing about Spaceballs is just again the level of detail. All the special effects are legitimate Star Wars quality special effects, and just the willingness to do something like put a hyperdrive on a Winnebago and make that a spaceship, which works both with having Lone Star and Barf being like sort of drifters through space, but it also in a way is kind of a dig at back when models used to be the way you made spaceships, practical modeling. That so often you would have spaceship models built from other things, and you could actually pick apart on the screen what found objects that spaceship was made of.
On the opening shot of Spaceballs is just a real classic, taking off the opening shot of Star Wars, where the ship goes in from overhead and it keeps on going and going and going. and not to mention it's also a great model on top of that.
But the other thing I love about that is that the orchestra doing the soundtrack for the movie gives up.
Yes. So, I mean,
the scene is so long.
We got a few more films left to cover in this sequel cast special and Mel Brooks's
Goodbye, Spaceballs.
Goodbye, Spaceballs. His next one is possibly his most obscure. I've only seen part of this. Life Stinks. Did you see this, Thresher?
I've seen it. It's not that good.
All
the elements are right. I mean, Mel Brooks, Weird Al Yankovic does music for it. Like, it should be...
What music did Weird Al Yankovic do in it?
The greatest comic expression of the go-go 80s, but instead it's a relic of the 80s stuck in the 90s.
And it's kind of like a spinoff of Prince and the Pauper with the storyline, right? I got to see...
It's about this wealthy... wealthy banker type who his life goes to hell.
Yeah, and the way Mel Brooks portrays the wealthy banker is very much in the same vein as President Scrooge from Spaceballs, or his goddamn it cell phone, or his part in Blazing Saddles. I forget his character's name in that film.
Oh, the governor.
Right, but it's that same sort of tone he does with the performance. I'd like to see this all the way through. Like I caught it. Streaming back when I had HBO, and I couldn't make it through 20 minutes of it, sad to say. So I'd be curious to check it out, but it's also one of the few of his films, along with the 12 Chairs, where it's not necessarily parodying a genre,
It's not a Mel Brooks parody. It's just a movie that Mel Brooks is in that he produced. It's shockingly enough, it's not really his style of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of gotten trapped in someone. It's almost like he's trapped in someone else's movie.
Even though he was a writer and directed it and produced it and stuff and acted in it, right, in the lead. So his next film 2 years later, Robin Hood, Men in Tights. This was the first Mel Brooks film I saw in the theater.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Men in Tights. And saw it with another friend of mine. We both were well-versed in a lot of Mel Brooks films. And it's a lot. I think Men in Tights is a lot of fun. Cary Elwes as a Robin Hood is just great casting.
Oh.
And Tracy Ullman as the witch.
Oh, Latrine. Yeah. And I love Richard Lewis as Prince John. And how he just plays it, he plays it as Richard Lewis.
Yes. And Patrick Stewart in the end in the cameo as King Richard the Lionhearted is great and probably one of his first comedic roles on film.
Oh, and Dick Van Patten is the bishop.
And Dick Van Patten was also in Spaceballs.
Oh yeah, King Roland, King of the Druids.
That's funny. She doesn't look Druish.
That's all we needed—a Druish princess.
Ah, jeez.
which is from Spaceballs, yes. And not Minute Tights. But yeah, Minute Tights just has some great, like, it's got some, it's not my favorite Mel Brooks movie, but it does have some great gags, you know, like, I love, like, the great physical comedy from Blinken, the blind sidekick to Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Great circumcision jokes with Mel Brooks's Rabbi Tuckman.
Well, and Dom DeLuise doing a parody of Marlon Brando as the Godfather, as much as the parody seems out of place in a Robin Hood spoof.
Yeah, and he's like the cotton balls in his mouth making him talk funny.
But it's such an accurate representation, and one thing I'd love to see, which I never have, is early in Mel Brooks' career when he was doing a lot of TV shows, he created and wrote in a TV show called When Things Were Rotten, which was like a Robin Hood parody. Yeah.
Which I believe had Dick Van Patten as Friar.
Yes, yeah. I've never seen it, but I'd be very, very curious. I don't know if...
There's some clips on the Shout Factory Mel Brooks collection, and one of the clips...
Is that Shout Factory collection that just came out that's like Mel Brooks rarities?
I think so, okay. Yeah. If you go to the AV Club website, they posted a clip from When Things Were Rotten from that collection where it's like the King of France is visiting Prince John, and so Robin Hood and his merry men pretend to be caterers to feed him terrible food to get France angry at Prince John. And it's Sid Caesar, who Mel Brooks used to work for on your show of shows, as the King of France, you know, speaking in a fake French accent with peppered with weird English words and eating this like hot pepper soup and just going nuts. It's really good.
I have to check that out. That sounds really interesting. I mean, you know, Men in Tights, it is a lot of it, you know, makes fun of the Kevin Costner film Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Oh, yeah. Yes, unlike some other Robin Hoods, I speak with an English accent. Yep. Which is not just Kevin Costner. I mean, no. I think even the... Who's the guy that did all the swashbuckling?
Errol Flynn.
Yeah, because I don't believe he had a British accent when he played
Robin Hood. I've never seen that Robin Hood. That's one of those films I've meant to see. I certainly have to check that one out. But Men in Tights, I think, is good. I actually have a soft spot for Mel Brooks's last film as a director. Came out 2 years after in 1995, Dracula, Dead and Loving It, starring Leslie Nielsen.
It's a fun movie. Yeah. Like, Leslie Nielsen gives an amazing performance in that movie. I think the thing that keeps Dracula, Dead and Loving It from working as well as it could is that the way vampires appeared in film had changed so much since Dracula came out.
Yeah, this was after Interview with the Vampire, but of course long before Twilight.
Which it does attempt to parody.
Yeah.
But it's like it doesn't latch on to a specific vampire cinematic tradition to satirize. So as a result, it's all over the place, and it really doesn't have that genre savviness that really holds Mel Brooks' other movies together.
I think also, as some of the other films, the more you've seen of old vampire films, specifically the Dracula film with Bela Lugosi, so much of this film is similar to that in structure and pacing and tone. The opening credits, I really liked Dracula, Dead and Loving It. You see a lot of ancient drawings throughout history of vampires with a really classical score, much as what you'd see in Universal horror movies from the 30s and 40s.
Something else I like this all comes down to Leslie Nielsen was just that scene where Dracula has a dream sequence where he can go out in the sunlight, and it's just like, I just love the line reading, "Look, I'm drinking wine and eating chicken." And it's just, I love the hammy accent that he brings to that role. And Mel Brooks, though, does make a kick-ass Van Helsing. I would love to see him play Van Helsing again.
Oh, he does, and you know, it makes me wonder, you know, recently Mel Brooks has adapted his films to Broadway musicals with the producers, and then, which is really successful, and then after that, Young Frankenstein, which didn't run on Broadway nearly as long as the producers, right?
Yeah, it was a flop.
Yeah, it didn't. Did they ever do a touring show of Young Frankenstein? I don't think they have yet in the continental United States.
Don't know, frankly.
Okay. I never got to see it in New York. Have you ever heard the soundtrack to it? Does it have good music?
Regrettably, no. Okay. I have not seen anything from the Young Frankenstein musical. In all honesty, I felt like Blazing Saddles would have made a better musical than Young Frankenstein.
From what I read at the time, Mel Brooks was considering doing a Broadway musical of either Spaceballs, Blazing Saddles, or Ian Frankenstein. And he went with Ian Frankenstein. That being said, I could also see him doing a stage musical of Dracula Dead and Loving It, if he really wanted to. But, you know, Mel Brooks is 86 years old, as of this recording, November 2012. I would love to see him direct another movie. He hasn't directed a movie in almost 20 years.
Which is a shame. I mean, yeah. Frankly, like, whenever I see him today on an interview, he's still got it.
Yeah, no, he's a really great interview, really funny. Well, not that I've interviewed him, of course, but, you know, just watching him and stuff on talk shows. I would love to see him do something else again. And in interviews he's mentioned, he has pitched MGM on the idea of doing a sequel to Spaceballs as a movie. And they keep on turning it down.
I believe there was a script, actually.
Was there a script? It could be, yeah.
Well, yeah, this is something for the I mean, there had been rumors that there had been a script that had been floating around for a while. Back when I went to, DexCon in New Jersey. This was in, I think, 2006. That apparently a script or a draft of it was leaked on the internet. There was a group of people that did a Spaceballs LARP that was supposed to be based on that sequel script, which apparently had something to do with like a Starbucks type thing trying to take over the galaxy. No one liked the game, but that could just be because they didn't do it right.
Yeah, no, it could be. That's interesting. I didn't know that. So, I mean, Mel Brooks, he had a
search for more money.
Yeah, he had a special on HBO a year ago where he kind of did a conversation with Dick Cavett, and he has a special coming up on HBO pretty soon here in November 2012 called Mel Brooks Strikes Back. And of course, tying into all that, aside from a re-release of his Blu-ray box set, which contains most of his films except for, regrettably, The Producers, Life Stinks, and Dracula Dead and Loving It, he is the Shout Factory set you were mentioning, Thrasher, that is just coming out, which I'd love to get, but it's fairly expensive.
Oh, actually, something I did want to talk about, because Mel Brooks has appeared in lots of other things, such as the Muppet movie, which we talked about. A movie I did not like that I loved Mel Brooks in was Robots.
Hmm. So that was a DreamWorks a CG cartoon?
Yeah, it was a DreamWorks animation.
I've never seen it. How is it?
It's kind of all over the place. Like, about every few scenes, you feel like they got in a new draft of the script and just started filming with that new draft from where they left off. Because it is kind of all over the place. It has a good premise, but it's hurt by a bloated cast.
Mm.
It is a feast for the eyes. It's brilliantly designed. And the other problem is that a lot of really good improvisers are on the cast, such as Robin Williams, Mel Brooks, and whatnot.
Okay, yeah.
They are the people who put this movie together are way too dependent on the improvisers being able to fill time on the screen. Mm. Robin Williams' character, who should be fun, is completely insufferable because it feels like they had him improvise for 3 hours and then just used every damn line he improvised.
As opposed to something like when he was the genie in Disney's Aladdin.
Yeah, where clearly they've picked and choosed, and they actually bothered to write a few important lines from him. With him in this, it's like he's making stuff up as he goes along. But I mean, like it has like a good moral that kind of keeps, well, a couple of kind of good kind of moral points that sometimes get lost underneath all the craziness that's happening. But Mel Brooks is really good in it, and the other thing it doesn't do right. There's something I absolutely hate in mediocre CGI animated movies, and that's when at the end of the movie every character starts dancing to a pop song for no reason. And I think
that happens
this
a lot.
First movie that it's cliche, and everyone that isn't a Pixar movie seems to do it now. And I think this might have been the first. It's certainly the first I remember.
They did that at the end of Labyrinth.
Pardon?
At the end of the Jim Henson movie Labyrinth, all the Muppets and shit dance in the bedroom to a David Bowie song.
But that's different.
It's not a cartoon?
That's not a pop song. That's a David Bowie song made for the movie.
Okay, right.
And it's not a full musical
What is the pop song they dance to at the end of Robots?
It's some like it's a James Brown remix. It's a James Brown song, but it's just like it. I cannot stand that moment. Like,
yeah.
I want to have an app on my phone that tells me, that gives me a 30-second warning before that part of the movie happens, so I can just leave the theater.
It takes you out of the movie. If you like Mel Brooks and want to check out the recent DVD set that just came out about his rarities throughout his career, even has an audio CD of a lot of his songs that he's done. It's called The Incredible Mel Brooks, An Irresistible Collection of Unhinged Comedy. And it's available on DVD from Shout Factory. Five DVD set plus one CD.
Nice.
So, looks really cool. So we've talked...
Oh, did you see him on Curb Your Enthusiasm?
I did. Yeah, on I think season 4 of Curb Your Enthusiasm, they did an extended thing throughout the season riffing on...
The producers.
Now, was that before it was a Broadway play?
Oh, no. This was after it was a huge Broadway success. Because that was the premise, is that Mel Brooks was tired of Broadway and was trying to find a way to make his own musical fail so he would never have to have anything to do with it.
And he cast Larry David and David Schwimmer?
Yeah, okay. He was setting them up to make the worst version of the producers ever so it would fall apart and he'd leave. But then it turns out guy's ability to ad-lib saves the version that they're working on.
Yeah, my sister watched that season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, and she was not that familiar with the producers, so she was very confused. So, very interesting.
But, and actually, that was one of Anne Bancroft's last appearances. Cause
you're right, his wife,
that season as well.
Yeah, no, his wife died, and it was really hard on everyone, and of course, Mel Brooks. His wife died, that's always a hard thing. But she was one of the, before she died, you know, she really was convincing him to make some of his movies into Broadway stage shows. And it was a big inspiration for that. So, all right, well, we've had a very enriching discussion here on Sequel Cast Special on Mel Brooks. I think I'd love to visit other directors in the show in the future, as time permits. If you like...
I think we'll have to.
Yeah, if you like a Sequel Cast Special, check us out at... along with SequelCast and Sequel Commentary at SequelCast.com. And if you like the show, you know, feel free to go to SequelCast.com and donate or visit one of our affiliates, such as Amazon. Or listen to us on Stitcher at Stitcher.com, and you can sign up at Stitcher.com/SequelCast. So, for a SequelCast Special, this is Matt.
And this is Thrasher.
Saying, Prisoners.
Peter Schwartz be with you.
I was going to go for Prisoners of Love, Blue Skies Above. Da 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 da.
Gotta keep our hearts in chains.
Da da da
da. Da 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 da. Which is another song that carries through some of his films.
What films does that carry through?
What is that? There's another film he did that uses that tune.
Blazing Saddles? Isn't that what he has in dance?
No, that's a French mistake. My memory is failing me, but there's... I could swear that he uses that melody in another one of his films, but I might have to rewatch all of his films to find it.
What a terrible, terrible thing to rewatch Mel Brooks' films. All right, good night, audiences, and let us know if you liked this video stream of the Sequel Cast Special. Either on the YouTube page you're watching this now on, or at facebook.com/sequelcast, or send us an email, sequelcast@gmail.com. For real, this is Matt.
And Thrasher.
Sequelcast Special. Saying...
Get out of here.
Get out of here. You filthy animal. Those sound effects are not going to turn up in the podcast feed. God damn. Okay, good night. This was fun. This was a lot of fun.